Great. So we'll go ahead and get into the topic. So I wanted to begin this evening by telling a story. And this is the story of a place called Kaga. Kaga is now in modern-day Ishikawa Prefecture in Japan. And so this story takes place in the kind of late 15th century, in the 1480s. And a group of people gathered at Honganji temples affiliated with our Honganji school. And this group consisted of some farmers, and it consisted of the local kind of low-level samurai, not the daimyo or the high-ranking samurai, but the low kind of low-ranking samurai, and of course the ministers of that temple. And this group of people had gathered to form what was called and what is called an ikki. And I want to talk a little bit about what an ikki is. And I think as I sort of explain what these people who got together at this temple in Kaga Province did, you'll kind of get a sense of what an ikki was all about. So this group of Jodo Shinshu Buddhists, people who believed in the Jodo Shinshu temple teachings, had gathered because they had a problem. And their problem was the governor of their prefecture, a local kind of second level feudal lord. His name was Togashi Masachika. And Masachika had been ordered by the shogun, the kind of the head samurai of all of Japan at that time, to go and take part in a battle. And so he had left the province and went off to fight in this battle. But in order, of course, to fight in a battle, what do you need? You need funds, right? You need money. You need to buy weapons. You need to be able to feed your soldiers and buy horses and feed the horses and buy armor and all of those very expensive items to go off to battle. And so in order to have that battle and to be able to successfully fulfill his duty to the shogun, he needed to raise taxes. So they would receive a certain amount of rice from all the farmers in the area, and that was the common form of taxation at that time, was people would pay taxes in rice. And so he raised the amount of rice. He said, "You need to give me more rice than you've been giving me so far." And so they went around, and his tax collectors went to all the farmers and all the merchants and all the local people and said, "You need to pay up. You need to give, you've been giving, say, one bushel of rice, and now we need two bushels of rice." And the farmers looked in their supplies of rice, and they said, "We don't have two bushels of rice. We don't even have one bushel of rice right now. We're just not able to provide and pay this tax. It's just impossible. We don't have the rice." And so when Masachika got word of this, he thought, "Well, this is not acceptable." So when he returned to Kaga, he accused these farmers and the local people and the low-level samurai. He said, "You know, you're just giving all your money and all of your rice, all of your taxes, you're giving to support your Honganji temples where you love to go and hear this teaching of the Nembutsu, and you're not paying taxes where you should, which is to me, which is to your to support the daimyo and to support the shogun." And so he then was started to make threats. "If you don't give me the rice, I'm going to come and take the rice." And so this created a big problem for these farmers and these low-level samurai, and for the temple as well, because these were the members of these temples. And so people from several temples and several of these farmers and these low-level samurai, they got together and they had a meeting. They said, "Okay, we have this problem. So what are we going to do?" And they made a decision. They said, "We're going to get together, we're going to work together, and we're going to fight back Masachika. We're going to resist. We're going to revolt. We're going to stand up for our rights and stand up for our temple and our community." And so they got together and they wrote out, "This is our plan. This is what we're going to do." And they wrote out their plan on a piece of paper. And then after they wrote that piece of paper, then, you know, they all They all said, we're going to do this. They wrote it out, and then they burned that piece of paper. And after they burned that piece of paper, they mixed the ashes of that paper with water, and they all drank some of that paper that they had made, that promise they had made there in the temple before Amida Buddha. And then they rang the bell to announce that this is what we're going to do. We made this promise before the Buddha. This is very, very serious. And because they had drank that paper with the ashes, that promise had become part of their bodies. And so they felt that now this is something we absolutely have to do. We've made a promise to the Buddha. And if we break this promise, then we're going to be breaking our commitment to the Buddha and to the teachings. And so it's something they were willing to die for. They were that serious about it. And so when they rang that bell, then they became an iki. So an iki is a group of people who make a decision. They make a commitment that we're going to work together for a common cause. And it could be something like this problem with the local feudal governor, or it could be a battle. The thing about an iki was that iki didn't necessarily have to be a Jodo Shinshu activity. Iki could be any sort of group of people, samurai. So you had many different kinds of iki at that time. But this iki was what was called an iko iki. And so an iko iki was an iki of what was called the Ikoshu at that time. And Ikoshu was another name for the Jodo Shinshu teaching. And so this school of Buddhism that the Honganji is a part of is called Jodo Shinshu by members of the Jodo Shinshu school, but people who were from other Buddhist traditions tended to call it Ikoshu. And Iko means kind of pointing it in one direction. And so this name, Ikoshu, was in many ways kind of appropriate because Jodo Shinshu Buddhists really were focused only on Amida Buddha, but they didn't call themselves Ikoshu because they had received the name Jodo Shinshu from Shinran Shonin, who was the founder of this school. So this group of low-level samurai and farmers led by the Buddhist priests of these Honganji affiliated temples, they then banded together and they got they got weapons. Some of them were the samurai, of course. They had proper swords, bows and arrows, various naginata and yari and all of the traditional weapons used by the samurai. The farmers, many of them did not have weapons. So they used things like scythes, they used sharpened bamboo sticks, they used whatever sort of items they had, around their home, around their farm, or things they could gather from the woods to use as weapons. And they resisted and they fought back against Masachika. And they fought so effectively that Masachika, of course, was not expecting to have much resistance from them, but they were so well organized and so committed that they managed to overthrow Masachika. They overthrew him and they managed to take over this Kaga province and install his uncle. His uncle then became the governor of this province. His name was Togashi Yasutaka. And Yasutaka was very friendly to the Iko Iki, and he was very supportive of them. And the result was that the Iko Iki actually were in control from then on of Kaga province. And the Iko Iki were directed by their priests, and their priests looked to the Honganji for guidance, looked to people like Denyo Shonin, who was the Gomonshu, the eighth generation Gomonshu at the time. And so these followers of the Iko Iki had managed to do something that had never before been done in that time in Japan, which was a group of peasants and low-level samurai had managed to rise up and overthrow the daimyo who was appointed by the appointed by the appointed by the shogun of Japan. So the leader who was appointed by the shogun of Japan, they managed to overthrow him, and then take over and take control of the country. And this sent shockwaves through the capital, because people up until then had never imagined something like this could happen. And people started to take the Ikkō Iki very seriously from then on. They realized that they were very powerful. And although they were not perhaps as well trained or as well outfitted, they didn't have as nice weapons and swords and things that perhaps the other armies would do that had the support of the shogun. But what they did have was a very strong belief in their purpose, and they were not afraid to go into battle or to even die in battle, because they believed that if they should lose their lives in battle, that they would surely be born into the Pure Land of Amida Buddha. And so they had no regrets and no fear. And I want to talk a little bit more later on about where they got that idea. In short, it comes from this Pure Land Buddhist teaching. This entrusting in Amida Buddha leads to birth in the Pure Land. And since they were being supported and directed in these efforts by the priests of their temples, they were certain that this too was a path to birth in the Pure Land. Should they lose their lives on the battlefield, that they would be assured to be born in the Pure Land of Amida Buddha. So they're very brave and very courageous. So this is what an Ikkō Iki was. And this Kaga Ikkō Iki was very famous because they managed to sort of overturn the local lord and to really take control of a whole province of Japan and continue to have control there for a number of years, almost 100 years. They were in control there in Kaga. And so the people then, from then on, the various daimyo and the leaders took the Ikkō Iki very seriously, and they weren't always very comfortable with them. So I want to talk about a couple more important Ikkō Iki events that happened in Japan around that time. Before I do, maybe I'll just pause for a moment, and if people have any sort of general questions about what an Ikkō Iki is, then I wanted to invite you to share those if you wish. Otherwise, we can carry on and talk a little bit more about a couple other of these Ikkō Iki events. Okay.
Question is this during the time of Tokugawa Ieyasu, and at that time?
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned it. That's a wonderful segue into the next section that I wanted to talk about. So Fred mentioned Tokugawa Ieyasu, and at the time of the Kaga, so the Kaga Iki was in 1488. That was 1488, where you had the Kaga Ikkō Iki. And at that time, Tokugawa Ieyasu was not born yet. So Tokugawa Ieyasu was born in 1543. But the reverberations of that and this practice of the Ikkō Iki continued on. So after the Kaga Ikkō Iki, again, as I mentioned earlier, the folks in Kyoto were very, very alarmed by what had happened. And so there was a lot of pressure on Benyo to bring these people under control. And they told Benyo, you know, you have to kick people out of the Honganji. And Benyo said something, very interesting. He said, to expel these people from the Honganji would be, to me, it would be like cutting off my own arm. It would be like removing a part of my own body. I just cannot do that. And so although there was tremendous pressure for him to expel them from the Honganji, he understood that for people at that time to be expelled from the Honganji would send them a message that they wouldn't be allowed to be born in the Pure Land. And they would be very worried and very afraid and upset by that. And so Instead, Denyo, he wrote a very sternly worded letter to the followers of who did this Iko Iki, but he stopped short of expelling them. But he said, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this. You really shouldn't be causing such trouble in this way. And so there was a long history following that of these Iko Iki. There was a question in the chat box about after they overthrew the daimyo, did the Iko Iki become local units of governance? So, you know, the government was very complicated. You know, you had several parties. You had the formal governor himself, and you also had the Iko Iki, which who were led by the temples. So the temple priests came to have tremendous influence, and they would defer to you know, even to Kyoto or to wherever the headquarters was, to Denyo. And so they would influence the governing to the extent that it impacted their own lives. So they had their own, the temples at that time were surrounded by these little temple towns. And people who lived in those Honganji temple towns were really under their own kind of jurisdiction. They had their own laws, their own, you know, they didn't pay taxes to the government. They were really allowed to have their own little world in there. And so, and these towns were the major cities in Kaga. And so all of the major cities were sort of run by the Honganji. And so in that sense, they continued to be the units of governance, and they were even more well established in their role as governing units following these successful battles. And so back to Fred's question about Tokugawa Ieyasu. So these Iko Iki continued to form, and it wasn't always a kind of a direct, you know, uprising, rebellion. They would make these groups to kind of protect their own interests. And certainly if they were challenged or if they faced a problem, they would come together and they would rise up. And another of these Iki formed in an area of called Mikawa. And this is in modern day Aichi Prefecture. So it's from where Ishikawa and Kaga is. This is another part of Japan. So you can see that this showed the influence of the Honganji all over Japan in many different areas. And so in this area of Mikawa, there were several daimyo who had been sort of in control. There was the Imagawas were in control for a number of years. And then there were also, you know, other important factors. There was the Odas, the Oda clan, like many of you probably heard of Oda Nobunaga and his family were also very powerful during that time, and they were just on the border there of Mikawa. But in the 1560s, we saw Tokugawa Ieyasu then begin to rise up as the coming rising up into power. And this was at the very beginning of Tokugawa Ieyasu's rise to power, and he was almost actually stopped from his rise to power by the Iko Iki. So that gives you a sense of, you know, really the power that these groups had. And if we think about the history of Japan, you know, the influence that Tokugawa Ieyasu had long-term in Japan really can't be overstated. And so Tokugawa Ieyasu was also building an army. So there's a common theme that we see here. So he was also building an army and wanting to strengthen his position, you know, sort of rising as a sort of rival to the Oda clan at that time. And so he was rising up and trying to become stronger. And so he also needed to raise taxes. In fact, he went so far as to continue a practice of taxing the local Honganji temple towns. Now, the thing about the Honganji temple towns is that up until that point, they hadn't been taxed at all. They had two important rights that they had. One was they didn't have to pay taxes. They didn't have to give their rice to the local daimyo. The other important right they had is that they were allowed to have their own jurisdiction. They were able to investigate any sort of crimes that had been committed in their temple town, and they were able to dole out, you know, punishments and justice accordingly. So they had a lot of freedom and a lot of autonomy within their own areas. And so there were two events that happened that are said to have given rise to this formation of an iki, and they happened at two different temples. So in one temple, they had the collection in the temple town, they had a collection of rice. And Ieyasu's samurai had run out of food and they needed more rice. So they went into the temple town, they grabbed as much rice as they needed, and they marched off with it, which under normal circumstances, any other town, Ieyasu's soldiers could go in and take whatever they needed, whatever they wanted, they could just take and leave, and no one had the power to say anything. But when they did this to this certain temple, the town that was attached to this temple, the people said, this is not acceptable. And so they formed this this group, and they went, and they went back, and they found the place where the rice was being held, and they went in and they took that rice back. They went back and brought it back to their area. And then it's said that when Ieyasu's samurai, they sent people, messengers, to inquire about this, that then those people were attacked and badly injured. And so that was one episode that happened. The other episode was that there was one of Ieyasu's samurai had gone to a merchant who lived inside this Honganji temple town and had burned down his house and chased him off. And so the people, then the other villagers, got together and they went and they attacked that samurai. And so normally, you know, if a samurai was untouchable, if he was at that high level, a commoner couldn't do anything. But these iko-iki would band together and they would go and they would fight even against the samurai. So he had that kind of courage and power. And so Ieyasu then realized that these people are not obeying me and I need to bring them under control. And so what ensued was a great battle between the iko-iki of Mikawa and Ieyasu. And interestingly, even some of Ieyasu's own samurai retainers who were believers in the Honganji went with the iko-iki and not with Ieyasu. So he realized that this iko-iki and this belief in the Honganji teaching is powerful enough that people will turn against their own samurai lord to join these iko-iki battles. And so Ieyasu, in the end, he had to work very hard, but he was able to finally bring the iko-iki under control. And they in the end, they had to negotiate a truce to agree to what they were going to do. And they managed to say, okay, we will, you know, we'll stop the fighting, but only if you promise that you won't punish the local samurai and the people who had joined our iko-iki group. And he managed to agree to that. But then Ieyasu, having consolidated his power in Mikawa, he banned Honganji. Honganji temples were banned from Mikawa. And it wasn't until 1582. So it was a period of, let's see, so the battles ended in 1564, so almost 20 years that Honganji was forbidden or banished from Mikawa, and then gradually they were allowed to return after that. So that was the sort of the first encounter with Tokugawa Ieyasu. I mentioned also Oda Nobunaga, and Oda Nobunaga was another sort of famous samurai lord warrior of that time. And Nobunaga was the first one following kind of the collapse of the Muromachi, that sort of that late Muromachi period, the collapse of the Ashikaga shogunate. Then Nobunaga was the first one to kind of reunify all of Japan. This was what's called kind of the Sengoku, or the warring states period of Japan, when you had all of these different groups fighting against each other, and lots of daimyo and samurai. And many of our favorite kind of samurai movies are set in this time. If you like Kurosawa movies, movies like Kagemusha and Dan are sort of set around that that Sengoku period of time. And so Nobunaga, he also, you know, wanted to maintain control. And so he managed to conquer most of Japan and kind of bring it all under his control. But what he found was the one group that he wasn't able to bring under control were these Honganji temple towns. And some scholars have estimated that the Honganji temple towns actually were most of the big cities in Japan at that time. And most of the wealth was concentrated in these cities where the Honganji had power. And so Nobunaga felt very threatened by them. But not just that, Nobunaga had many enemies, many other daimyo who wished to take over and wished to you know, not be under his control. And so he, these other daimyo, such as Takeda Shingen and Asakura Yoshikage, they banded together with Honganji to resist and to fight against Nobunaga. So we see this these Iko-Iki Honganji groups. They start, you know, very small, kind of backwoods prefecture of Kaga, and it begins, you know, kind of these small episodes, but then they take over the whole prefecture. You know, then they challenge Ieyasu, and Ieyasu manages to bring them under control, but it's much closer to kind of the center of where things are happening. And then it goes to a kind of national level with Nobunaga. And then this conflict with Nobunaga takes place shortly after the battle between Ieyasu and the Iko-Iki. And Nobunaga, he begins to infringe upon the rights of the Honganji temples, and especially the Honganji itself. At that time, Honganji was based in what is now Osaka, where you have Osaka Castle. These days, that's where the Ishiyama Honganji, the Honganji Temple was. And so the whole city of Osaka, a major, major economic center in Japan at the time, was basically a giant Honganji temple town. And so Oda Nobunaga began to levy very, very heavy taxes on the Osaka, the Honganji temple town. And so Kenyo Shonin, the 11th Gomonshu, so he's three generations after Denyo, Kenyo takes a very different attitude. Remember, Denyo said he sort of sent a letter to the Honganji temple saying, you know, you really can't be causing this sort of trouble, knock it off. Kenyo takes quite the opposite approach. He appeals to his members saying, Nobunaga, since he's come to the capital, he's causing us all kinds of trouble. And so, you know, me am on my own, I'm not able to resist him. But if we all pull together for the sake of our teaching, then I think we can ensure the future of our teaching. If we don't, our teaching is going to be in grave danger because of Nobunaga. And so the Honganji then proceeds to have this revolt or battle against Oda Nobunaga. It's called the Ishiyama Gassen, or the Ishiyama War, where the Honganji, the main Ishiyama Honganji temple, is laid siege to. It's attacked for over 10 years and is not defeated, but rather is able to continue. And finally, after 10 years of battle, and it's not just in Kyoto, it's all over Japan. These Ikoiki groups are banding together with the local samurai warriors to fight against Nobunaga. So there's this big war, and Honganji temples are fighting in all these areas. And in the end, Nobunaga manages to pin them down so that Kenyo has to escape. He gets on a boat and he sails to what is now in Wakayama prefecture, was Kii province at the time. And so Honganji is moved to this kind of out of the way area, but his oldest son Kyono remains in the area and continues to kind of resist Nobunaga until finally after Nobunaga's death, then Nobunaga's successor, Hideyoshi, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who's another sort of famous samurai leader, he then grants Honganji some land that is to be the Honganji. And so you can see, I don't know if you see the wagesa I'm wearing today is a little different than the one I usually wear, but you see it has this crest, which is different from our usual Sagari Fuji. And this crest here is the Hideyoshi crest, Toyotomi Hideyoshi's crest. And so because Honganji Nishi Honganji received the support of Hideyoshi, and the land where our head temple sits was donated by Hideyoshi, so we have we use his crest sometimes. You probably can't see it, but also on this Bohonzon here, you can see the crest. We have the Sagari Fuji, which is our main crest, and then the Hideyoshi crest, Sagari Fuji and the Hideyoshi crest, and they're sort of interspersed in this way to show our close relationship with Hideyoshi. After the fallout of this battle with Nobunaga, Honganji is very much weakened, and it isn't until then Hideyoshi grants land to Kenyo's third son, who is called Junyo. And Junyo is then designated as the Gomonshu. First he designates Kyonyo, but then Junyo's mother produces a letter which says, see, it should be Junyo. And so then Hideyoshi decides, okay, you designate Junyo. But later, Tokugawa Ieyasu, when he comes to power following Toyotomi Hideyoshi's death, then Ieyasu designates Kyonyo, the first son, as Gomonshu, and gives him land at Nanajo in Kyoto and Karasuma. So that's where our current Higashi and Nishi Honganji temples are. And so the location of these temples was determined by these two famous samurai warlords. Toyotomi Hideyoshi was close to the Nishi Honganji, and Tokugawa Ieyasu was close to the Higashi Honganji. And so this history of kind of the Japanese battles for control that ultimately resulted in this rise of Tokugawa Ieyasu, Honganji history was very much intertwined in that history. And so what could have motivated these farmers and these simple low-level samurai to rise up and to sort of rise above their station, so to speak, to take on the most powerful warlords of their time? And I think we find the answer to that in this Nembutsu teaching, the inspiration that people took from the Nembutsu teaching, Shinran Shonin's teaching, his wasan, that members of this Nembutsu community would chant every day. So here at the San Mateo Buddhist Temple, even just before we started our session this evening, we had the chanting of Shoshinge, where we chanted the words of Shinran Shonin, and then after that, we chanted six wasan. And so that's a practice that Nenyo encouraged, and those who followed in his community would have also done that. And so these Ikoiki fighters also had these Nembutsu, these wasan in their mind. So I want to just show a few of those wasan now to kind of give you a little flavor of those. Oh, I see there's another question. Let's see, before we go on to this wasan, let's look at this question. After the overthrow, did Iko Iki have to continue fighting their neighbors or others who might have been after their valuable ration of rice? So after the Honganji temples were, for the most part, they were able to, the temples themselves were able to kind of maintain, you know, their position, although they didn't have as much influence. And what Ieyasu did was he really kind of brought everything under control in an orderly system. And the Honganji, although it was weakened by being split in two, remained quite powerful throughout, you know, the Edo period or under Ieyasu. He was a patron and favored the Higashi Honganji, but we see even the Nishi Honganji remained powerful because they had these deep roots in the community. And so it shows also, I think, the kind of resilience of their, that comes from the community that's grounded in this Nembutsu teaching, that it's so deep in the hearts and the minds of the people that even when the political situation changes, their support for the temple continues. And so after Ieyasu comes into power, he really regulates the behavior of the samurai and makes the society very orderly. It's very hierarchical, but it's also very orderly. So you don't have these sort of roving bandits that you have in the period that was leading up to Ieyasu taking control. Let's look at some of these wasan of Shinran Chonin. These will give us kind of a sense of the teachings that inspired these people. So So we have, these are the kind of thing, these are the wasan. People would have chanted these every morning. And these are a certain section that I think is particularly powerful, called the hymns on benefits in the present life. But it's this one, for example, says, when we say Namo Amida Butsu, which surpasses all virtues, our heavy obstructions of evil, past, present, and future, are all unfailingly transformed, becoming light. So this is the idea that a person who says the Nembutsu, whatever things that they've done, any sort of evil or wicked things that they've done, that all of that bad karma is erased through the power of the Nembutsu. So you can imagine, somebody who's gone into battle, and is having to, do all of these things in battle to win the war, fighting with others and, hacking at them with swords and shooting arrows at people. As a Buddhist, of course, our perspective is we should be peaceful and we should not kill any living beings. And so, these teachings would have given people a way to kind of understand how to navigate the reality of their time, because it was sort of an eat or be eaten sort of society at the time, and they were in many cases sort of fighting for their survival. And this is an interesting question. I'd like to kind of get into this more in the discussion session, in a few minutes, about this sort of warfare and Buddhism and how we can understand that from a Buddhist perspective. There's others of these about, kind of removing bad karma. This handout is available on the website. Those of you who saw the email that I sent out, so there's a link to this handout in the email that I sent. If you'd like to check this out later, I certainly encourage you to take a look at these hymns of Shinran. The other kind of powerful wasan that we have here are these wasan that talk about being protected. Here's a great example, this number 104. When we say Namu Amida Butsu, Yama, the king of the dead, reveres us. And the officers who judge the beings of the five courses of existence all protect us day and night. So there's this traditional East Asian teaching that's not limited to just the Jodo Shinshu, but it's kind of common throughout East Asian Buddhism and other ideas, that when a person dies, then, you know, at the end of their life, there's this king of the dead who judges people and decides if they've been good or bad. And so, you know, again, you know, this idea that, well, if I die on the battlefield, then because I say the Nembutsu, then Yama will protect me, and I will not be punished, you know, for the things that I've done in this lifetime. This next one is also very powerful. The gods of the heavens and the earth are all to be called good because they protect the person of the Nembutsu. And then we'll just look at one more here. Sorry, didn't get all in one nice little piece. Let me spread this out a little bit so we can see it here. It's in two columns, but it says, countless Amida Buddhas reside in the light of the Buddha of unhindered light. Each one of these transformed Buddhas protects the person of true and real Shinjin. So the sense that people who say the Nembutsu are protected by the Buddhas. And so for somebody who is going into battle and, you know, might be a very frightening situation, they would have the confidence in knowing they were protected by the Buddha. And if they were to die on the battlefield, that they would be assured of birth in the Pure Land. And so there's the banners that they would carry when they went into battle would say things like, if you advance and go forward, you go forth into birth in the Pure Land. If you fall back and retreat, you'll fall into hell. And things like that, this way of really motivating people using this this Buddhist perspective. So I wanted to share one more passage and then kind of switch gears and open up for questions and discussion here. This is from the letters of Denyo. I don't want to read this whole letter right now, but it's talking about Denyo. This is Denyo, who was very influential also in this time and with these Go Iki followers. And his letters would have been read constantly by these people every day as a part of their morning ritual. And here Denyo is talking about the importance of trusting in the Buddha, but this metaphor, he uses the metaphor of the loyal retainer and the faithful wife. And I think that this would have kind of really resonated and hit home with folks. So I just want to conclude this sort of section by reading this letter of Denyo Shonin, and then I'd like to turn off the recording and open up for some discussion and some Q&A in the portion that remains. So Denyo Shonin writes, "Why is it that in relying on Amida Tathagata, we completely reject the myriad good deeds and practices, designating them as the sundry practices? It is because of the great vow in which Amida Buddha has promised to save beings who rely on him single-heartedly and steadfastly, however deep their evil karma may be. Therefore, single-heartedly and steadfastly means that we take no other Buddha as peer to Amida Buddha. This is the same as the rule in human society that one relies only on one master. Hence, in the words of an outer Buddhist, non-Buddhist text, a loyal retainer will not serve two masters, a faithful wife will not take a second husband. Since Amida Tathagata is the original teacher and the master of all the Buddhas of the three periods, how can all the Buddhas who are his disciples not rejoice when they hear that we rely on the one, on that one who is the master? You must understand the grounds for this very thoroughly." And then Denyo goes on to talk more in depth about the nature of entrusting in the Buddha. But you know, this metaphor is very powerful because it reinforces this sense of loyalty and you know, fidelity to the Buddha, of course. But then also using this metaphor, I think, would have really resonated with people in this time of feudal loyalties and people who perhaps going into battle. And so we see how these teachings of the Nembutsu were able to inspire these people with great courage. And if we think about it, this is a time when peasants and these members of the Iko-Iki groups were often described in records written by the samurai they fought against as totally useless beings. So their value as a human being was not recognized. And yet they were able to really rise up and to take control of their situation and their destiny, inspired by this very powerful teaching. And if we think about it, you know, this teaching has throughout, you know, its history, since the time of Benyo in particular, played this major role in Japanese society. That's one of the reasons that we hang the portrait of Benyo in our hondo along with Shinran. So if you look at the statue of the Buddha, Shinran is on the right and Benyo Shonin is on the left. And Benyo is sort of considered the second founder of Honganji because he was the one who was really able to create this robust organization that was able to survive. And when you read the writings of people like Benyo Shonin and Kenyo Shonin, they really talk about this as the survival of the teaching. You know, if it weren't for the strength of these Iko-Iki communities during this Warring States period, the Honganji would have been wiped out, and with it, this teaching of the Nembutsu. So this raises some really interesting questions about our way of thinking about Buddhism as a peaceful religion. And also, I think in our modern day, when we see people sort of raising up their voices and various uprisings and kind of rebellions in our own American society, I think it's interesting for me to kind of look back at this history of the Nembutsu, what that was about, and then what the uprisings we're seeing today are about, and where there's resonance and perhaps where there's difference. So I want to kind of leave those as open topics for us to explore in some conversation and discussion right now. I want to sort of conclude this recorded portion with Gassho and then transition into the discussion. So I invite you to please join me in Gassho. Namo Amida Butsu.
Namo
Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu.